to say, actually, we want to get carbon neutral, not by 2050, maybe by 2040, because we've now got so much evidence to say there's so much goodwill across the nations of the world to actually change our behaviors to make the planet sustainable.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Stephen Kelly. Stephen has over 30 years experience in both UK and US public tech companies. He was the CEO of Sage Computing and held a position as a COO of the UK government. In this conversation, we talk about his upbringing, his vision for the future, and his love for music. The music choice has been shortened for rights reason. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way independent podcasts like this get to survive. The program is also broadcast weekly on Dublin's Near FM 90.3. The title music is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
So look, I'm here with Stephen Kelly, and thanks a million for your time, Stephen. I tell you what, I'm going to start from the coronavirus, because I think it's just such a life-changing thing for us all. I just want to know what's happening in your community, and how is it shaping up for you, where you are, the virus?
Yeah, you know, Andrew, it's something that none of us anticipated, even back at the beginning of February. I guess at the macro level, it amazes me how not malleable but adaptable human beings are, and we've totally changed our lives and done it in a very obedient, compliant way to support everybody facing this kind of international crisis and emergency. For us, down at a very granular level, we've locked down. It's weird, actually. I've spoken to a lot of people, zoomed for Ireland and England, really, and busy times. And I've sort of checked in with people quite a lot, and generally there seems to be two camps. I'd say 80-90% of people, ironically, have really enjoyed the lockdown or some parts of it. Like, it's not 100%, but. But they're almost a bit fearful to say that because they don't think that's the thing to say. They think it's like we're in suffering and sacrifice. But actually, they've really enjoyed it. I think it's helped with the weather. The weather's been stunning, generally, apart from one week. But, people have really enjoyed the peace, the tranquility, just a bit more time to reflect, a bit more time to do things, whether it's kind of cleaning out the house or reading books or whatever you plan to do on the to-do list, your sort of New Year's resolutions list that you never actually get around to do. So for me on a personal level, we never would have expected. We've got three daughters who are 26, 23, and 20. And they've all moved away from home. And two of them kind of in London, one and up in Oxford. And we never would have expected them to come home apart from like Christmas, maybe. And it's sort of like Christmas every day without the trees and the presents and Santa. Remarkably, we've gone incredibly well. It's adult-to-adult relationships. We constructed a rota of cleaning duties, cooking and stuff like that. And we kind of all mucked in. And it's been a real pleasure. It's what, week eight now, week seven, week eight. And it certainly made me think of things that I've talked about a lot, which have come true quicker than I ever thought it would have done. So, number one for most companies, they've sort of done more digital transformation in 5 weeks than they did in 5 years. For us, the world of flexible working is prime time now. It's come to life and everybody's doing it. Everybody's working from home. And actually, talking to chief executives in the last week, tons of them saying, we think we're more productive than ever in our companies. And then other things, you know, probably not so good. With all these sort of things, there's unintended consequences. Probably for some of the sort of retail trade and the high street, it may have accelerated the decline of that a decade during this crisis. So it's really tough to see some of the fantastic restaurants and pubs and little community shops that are going to come back. And I think, you know, all of us, I'd encourage us to support that community, because I think that's really important to provide glue and be a sort of bond to keep people together. But anyway, so on a personal level, you know, we never would have gone into this, but reflections are actually more people have found space to reflect, whether they do yoga, meditation, or just be with themselves more to think about life, what they want to do, what their choices are. And I would say as well, Andrea, that probably a lot of the people I talk to, you know, are very lucky. They've got gardens, so they've got a bit of space. I do feel, you know, sorry for folks who are up in a high-rise tower block on the 12th floor with no balcony, no green space, and probably amazingly beautiful, but probably sometimes demanding young children running around their flats or their dogs or pets or whatever. So, you know, we sort of live in a bubble, and I acknowledge that. And so therefore, sort of voices I talk to are maybe a bit of an echo chamber.
Lovely. Tell me about your first song, Stephen. Van Morrison, Brown Eyed Girl. Why did you pick that one?
Yeah. God, this is, everybody would have said this, I'm sure. To get it narrowed down to seven songs that sort of define your life are so difficult, because there's just so many you have to leave out, which is brutal, but you have to make choices. So Brown Eyed Girl, Van Morrison, I've seen Van Morrison loads of times, obviously from Ireland, brilliant songwriter, singer, probably not the most lively in concert, to be honest with you, but his songs are just, you know, moon dance, and this one I picked out, Brown Eyed Girl. It's sort of, if you ask my daughters, you know, what would my song be to define me, it's probably this one, Brown Eyed Girl. Lots of energy, lots of passion, you know, a bit of romance, and just a fantastic, fantastic song.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game, laughing and running, hey, hey, skipping and jumping in the misty morning fog with our hearts are thumping, and you, my brown-eyed girl, and you, my.
I did a bit of research and I heard a couple of interviews. The latest one you did with Simon Haig, and that was a really nice interview. It was obviously all about leadership and so on, and very specific about your business and his business. But as you know, I'm more interested about the person behind all of that. You know, and you mentioned a couple of times about growing up, working class upbringing, if I'm correct. Can you just tell me a little bit more about that? Just a little bit about where you grew up and what was that all about? What was it like?
Yeah, I grew up in a seaside town, down in a place called Folkestone, down by Dover. And actually, it was probably quite a glamorous time after the Second World War, when people went on holiday in the UK. But then obviously the package tour started off to Spain and stuff, and it became a pretty depressed place, which only had a season of like 8 weeks, and then everybody kind of leaves. So it was a tough sort of, there wasn't a lot of jobs, there wasn't a lot of employment. And we were working class. My dad had a sort of small business, a tea and coffee shop, cafe. And that sort of defined me when I look back on it. And a lot of the sort of voices I hear from mum and dad about, you know, hard work killed no one, you know, you've got to kind of get out there and whatever it takes, really, whether you have to scrub floors or do whatever you do to earn an honest day's living. And all the sort of values around treating people as you expect to be treated yourself. So this sort of concept around this ethic where, you know, you work hard, you build value, you do right by people, helped me during that time. The other thing, probably was quite seismic at the time, was when I was about 14, my dad got sick. So, you know, I think on reflection, probably mental health issues. But he had what was called a nervous breakdown at the time, and he just spent three or four years probably predominantly in bed. And I remember it was weird in the house of we young teenagers, my brother and I sort of rushing around, dad's resting. So, but also it's just not that concept of seemingly a bit surreal, but we all just had to kind of double down and go get jobs. So I had, probably between about 14 and 18, I did labouring, I did two paper rounds, I sold ice creams on the seafront, I worked for Sainsbury's, a retailer, grocers, I worked in hotels, and it's tough. Actually, hotels, it is tough work because you're doing sort of split shifts. You get up for the breakfast shift, so I cycle down to the hotel at 5:30 in the morning, just to start preparing for breakfast and all that sort of stuff. Serve breakfast, you leave by 11 o'clock after you've hoovered everything and cleaned it up, and then you're back there an hour later serving lunches. And then again, you kind of finish in the afternoon, you could be back on a shift for dinner. So it's tough. And I think that defines you, like my brother and sister as well. They went out and got jobs. So this is back in the 70s. I would have been paying £5 a week housekeeping into my mum. And then also, the sort of visible impact of what happened was I had to sell the business. My mum did all that. She became a full-time worker. So she was a great role model, actually, for picking up and sort of saving the family. In many respects, became the primary breadwinner. And then I was sort of instrumentally involved. It was Simon, he talked about leadership, and I never expected this, I never wanted it, but it was sort of thrust upon you. So I remember being the key instigator of selling our house and downsizing and eventually swapping it for a much smaller house, selling a car, all this sort of stuff, which I'm like 14, 15 years old, just, needs must, and you kind of got to muck down and just get on with it. So it sort of defined the sort of work ethic I had. It sort of defined the value I place on things and not on material things. I wouldn't call myself material at all, but also just living in your means, but also seeing a role model of your mum just doing whatever it takes, leaving the house at 6, coming home at 10 o'clock. And she did loads of different jobs, delivering catalogues, working at Tesco. And it just sort of defines a really tight-knit family unit who just got on with it and just sort of managed through a crisis. So that actually, when I look back on it, is probably the first sort of moment that was actually unwelcome and not something I searched at all, but my first moment of leadership.
Fabulous. Tell me about Don't Stop Me Now by Queen.
So we love celebrating. I guess we love life. And we love celebrating. So, birthdays back in the day, christenings, celebrations. And we normally have pretty big parties, big family parties. And, they're pretty iconic and fun. Because we love, just having, it's nothing more joyous than seeing family members and friends and lots of love. So one of the songs which, when it comes on, and Queen, what an iconic band, probably one of my regrets is not going to see them live, but what an amazing band and just, pioneers in music in the 70s. But just this song, when it comes on, at night, and it's a party, you just can't stop yourself. You've got to put your drink down. You've got to go out there on the dance floor, and you've got to rip it up and just pretend you're 20 years old again.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
I like the way you have to put the drink down first.
You have to. pint of Murphy's or pint of Guinness. Depends whether you're from Cork or Dublin.
Lovely. I love the way you described your childhood there and your upbringing. And it was obviously, there was some serious stuff going on with your dad and your mom working hard. But at the same time, you describe it quite fondly. There was a lot of love and a lot of unity, as you mentioned, within your family. How did you go from there to the next? What was the next step then? How did you move on? Did you go to college, or did you have time to go to college?
Yeah, it's interesting. I do lots of stuff in schools and kind of particularly sort of areas where there's deprivation and challenge in terms of working class schools and that environment. And they asked me kind of what advice would I give them. And, I haven't got words of wisdom in many respects, because when I look at my life, some of it was planned, but some of it was luck. And I know, was it Gary Player or Rory McIlroy say, the harder you practice, the luckier you are. When I left Folkestone at 18, my brother, my sister and I were the first generation to ever go to college. So we went away to college. And I didn't plan this, that I'd never go back. I guess romantically, I'd love to have gone back to Folkestone because it's kind of where you grew up. But when I left college, I got a job and I went to London, and I never went back to Folkestone. Obviously, I went back to visit, but I never went back to live. So my life kind of completely moved away. And when I rationalized that afterwards, I just realized, well, there were no jobs there. Apart from the local government or customs and excise down at Dover in the port, there was kind of no jobs. And it's ironic, actually. This kind of keeps my feet on the ground. A load of the guys that I went to school with, who are still mates today, they were smarter than me. They were smarter than me. They were better in class than me and stuff like that. But because they stayed in Folkestone, they went off to become, postmen. I had a buddy of mine work in the ticket office at British Rail. Another guy worked behind the counter at Barclays for like 30 years. And they just kind of got into the routine of staying at home, going out and getting a job, and whatever job they could get. It just shows you the lack of opportunity in some of these places. Whereas I, almost by accident, went away and never went back. And that just opened my eyes to a just completely different landscape, a landscape of opportunity. And it kind of made me realize that, sadly, opportunity is very unequal. And if in terms of giving back, I was state educated, I got a full grant when I went to college. So I've always felt if I can give back to the next generation, who may be either disadvantaged or don't see that opportunity thrust upon them, as some of the children, from very privileged upbringings, then that's something I, can do and make a difference on. So, I left, went to college, and honestly, I never looked back. But I've got fond memories of that growing up, as you rightly say. And I've still got loads of mates back at home. And once a year, I go home and play a game of cricket with them all. And, it's weird. You go, I don't know what this is, just everybody at my stage in life. You kind of go back to these folks every year who are your mates 40 years ago and still friends today. And you sort of have some of the same conversations you had back then, and some of the anecdotes and some of the funny storytelling that really makes it fun. You have a good laugh.
Eva Cassidy, the Fields of Gold, a version of Sting, was it? Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, Eva herself was iconic and had a very tragic story battling cancer. But it's about the song as well. It's almost like this does connect to me back to Fields of Barley, running around as a kid. My brother and I, I loved him to bits. Sadly, only passed away a couple of years ago. Just 4 years older than me, and we used to just be, just running around like that book Swallows and Amazons as kids. This is when I was like 7, 8, 9, and total freedom, running around, exploring. Looking butterflies, bees, birds, all that sort of stuff, building camps. And a lot of that, in terms of the autumn, was running through fields of barley and wheat and all that. So it sort of connects, and I can see the gold visual, and feels very warm and, you know, very sensitive to me. And now, you know, when I love going walking, love the countryside, love nature, and do quite a few walking holidays. At that time of year, when you see fields of barley, fields of wheat, and they just kind of wave in the wind, it's an almost like an eternal song connecting land, humans, and it gives me great appreciation.
You remember me when the west wind moves among the fields of barley. You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while.
When I first came across you, it was through Samantha Kelly, and the thing that struck me was the CEO. You know, I think your Twitter handle is S. Kelly CEO. Am I correct? Yeah.
And, yeah. Yep.
And I worked in corporate in my past, and my experience of a CEO was a different experience of what I heard you talking about CEO. So, tell me about what is a CEO to you, because you've been a CEO of different companies. You speak to CEOs every day. What is a CEO, and what does it take to be a CEO?
So a CEO is just a normal human being. And I think we forget that. And sometimes when CEOs are portrayed in the press, obviously, you know, occasionally they're vilified. But the reality is, of all the CEOs, I know lots and lots of CEOs, they're good people. They want to do the right thing. They're very human. Most of them have got their feet on the ground, you know, kind of golden rulers. You never forget where you came from, because we all end up in the same place. And this is about a life's journey, where as a CEO, you want to be the best CEO you can be. So obviously, you are thrust into leadership. You do get advice, you know, to just a counter when you're a CEO. You get advice from a lot of people about sort of taking a profile that means you're sort of in the back seat in many occasions. But you get, and I found this as a CEO in all the companies I worked, it's amazing what people say. So I, you know, as a CEO, obviously, what do? You love your customers, you build great products, you build great services, you love your people who work for you, your employees, your colleagues. And if you do that, you know, I think it's overcomplicated, because at the end of the day, if you've got customers, you've got amazing customers who are very loyal to you, and you've got amazing employees who work for you, who are your colleagues, and you want to support them to be the best they can be every day, serving customers, then it's almost two sides of a perfect coin, customers and colleagues. And if you do that really, really well, then that probably creates a culture where you're building a fantastic company and it's growing and it's successful. And then obviously everybody else, all the other stakeholders, are really delighted about your success as a company. And that includes the investors, your suppliers, the community, partners, all those really important people who are the stakeholders in your success. So I think the job is you know, most at its most simple level, to lead a company, to lead a group of people, and to have a mission and a vision where you're going to become a great player in the marketplace. And do that and grow. And I think with companies, you know, growth, we used to say, sort of cures most evils. If you're growing and you're successful and you're hiring, it's a fantastic environment to be in, because it means then people get promoted, people have investment on leadership development, people have training, people have more flexible working probably, and probably people have better kind of Christmas holiday parties and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, is important to colleagues and employees. So I think all the great CEOs I've known are very authentic, very down to earth, and there's many of them out there. The other factor is sometimes you hear stuff which just it's like Chinese whispers. So I used to do a lot of like fireside chats every month. I did all hands meetings with all our colleagues and stuff like that. And I was very much a believer in terms of CEOs and leadership. When things are going incredibly well, then you want to put the team on the stage and let them take the accolades. And obviously in times of crisis, then that's the moment where you have to come forward. You know, like the crisis of Corona, you're seeing a lot more visibility from chief executives standing forward, you know, taking the bullets and saying, you know, this is the mountain we've got to climb together. So with that philosophy, what you hear sometimes is, you know, Stephen said this or Stephen said that or Stephen said the other. And in my experience, maybe not 9 times out of 10, but that just wasn't true. So what you find is there's this kind of, you try and communicate, because I think communication is probably one of the key skills of great chief executives. And you try and communicate very authentically and transparently and with great clarity. But sometimes that's either misinterpreted, and when it kind of hits the ground where it's meant to have an impact, it gets kind of, I hate to use the word manipulated, but maybe people just either don't interpret it or use it to their own end. So, you know, reality is that's when people can misconstrue stuff. But generally, chief executives, good people, want to do the right thing. And, you know, I encourage everybody. It's just another facet of leadership. You know, Andrea, in your business, you're a leader. And I think great companies, actually, I'd always encourage everybody to be a leader and be the best leader that they can be. Because, you know, at the moment, just in this crisis, I've encouraged a lot of companies I'm involved in to help with, like, mental health support of people working from home. And that could look like setting up a buddy program. So a buddy of someone who's, you know, working in that tower block in the centre of Dublin, on the 12th floor, who hasn't got open spaces that they could have gone to in the last 6 weeks, it's quite important for someone to reach out to them, to put their arm around them metaphorically, and to check in with them. And that's leadership. So, you know, I wouldn't underestimate leadership in every respect. It's just being there for people, providing clarity, providing a direction, and bringing people with you. And I think when you see great leadership, it tends to be people who are quite decisive, people who prioritize very, very well, and people who can bring people with them on that journey and that adventure.
Lovely. Tell me about Bing Crosby, True Love.
So, the other things I kind of remember, we were sort of quite dutiful, pretty compliant, actually. And in my early 20s, I met my life partner and Siobhan. And we went and got married up in St. George's Cathedral in Elephant and Castle, Kennington. And then afterwards at the reception, I had, you know, obviously one of the happiest days of your life, really. We love jazz as well. So we had a great jazz band, Louis Armstrong, all that sort of stuff, Muddy Waters. And then the first song for the dancing was this song, True Love. And, it was an iconic film. There's probably better songs around, but it just has great memories associated with it. High Society, Louis Armstrong, Grace Kelly, Bing Crosby. A good movie, but an iconic song where actually Bing Crosby serenades Grace Kelly. And the reason why I picked this is it's just amazing memories. Whenever I hear this, it kind of takes me back to that first dance when we got married.
Suntan, wind blown, honeymooners at last alone, feeling far above par. Oh, how lucky we are.
Another thing that struck me when I was researching you, there was a thing you did with the government. You went into the government to work as a COO for government and efficiency and reform. And you know Michael O'Leary of Ryanair. He always says, "Put me in charge of the government for 3 months, and I'll make it profitable." What was your experience? Because obviously, as a CEO, you're nobody. The shareholders are your customers, your primary customer. You need to make sure that they're happy with what's going on. what was it like going in? Because I know you've done some great work there. Just tell me a couple of things that actually worked in the time you were in the government advisory board.
Yeah, so I went off after really what was the deficit reduction of the credit crunch crisis. So our mission was to try and improve the civil service in Britain to be super efficient. And an interesting thing is, you know, golden rule of being a leader is who are my stakeholders, is to answer that clearly. So our stakeholders, we saw citizens of Britain, 60 million people. We wanted to deliver fantastic public services to them. Obviously taxpayers, so we wanted to run things really efficiently for them. And the way the civil service works is really the civil service is the executive of the government, and the governments get elected by the people. So it's almost like the visual of the government is the board, the civil service is the executive. And it is almost like, if you think of it like that, at a simple level, we were there to drive these programs around reform. And some of the most successful programs for folks in the UK are things like GovUK, which is the, just to give you context, before this, I think there was 132,000 URLs. And it was madness when I went in. I talked to one of the departments and I talked to them about their website. And I said, how long does it take to make a change? And they said, it could take 3 months. And I said, well, how much did it cost? And at the time, they said, for a simple change, it's probably about £29,000. And I said, wow, that's just mad. And it was all outsourced. So we set about, the team all the credit, put a strategy together, bring this in-house, and get brilliant civil servants, people from the private sector, to build GovUK. And it took 18 months to do that. And it won loads of awards, both for design, beat things like the Olympics and I think the Shard and all those sort of things for design awards. But also the user experience, you know, citizens loved it. And it eliminated a lot of the paper in the day as well, Andrea. There's a place in Swansea where the DVLA, which is the Driver Vehicle Licensing Agency, sits. And I think it was every day, I think 18 juggernauts went down the M4 full of paper of car tax discs. So all that was eliminated because everything went online, everything went digital. So, you know, it's good for the planet. It was good for the roads. There were a few people driving paper all around the country with government bureaucracy, really. It was great for citizens. It saved, over that period of 5 years of the coalition government, it saved about £50 billion. Much of that was all audited by the National Audit Office. So and how do you connect people? So I found the best experience really was how brilliant the civil servants were, because they all want to do the right thing. They're super bright. They're very clever. And really, you know, just your role as a leader is to connect them to what they love. And actually, one of the leadership things I've learned is really important is how to connect the head, the heart, and the hands. If you connect the head and the heart, the hands will motor and you'll build momentum. So the way we did it is really through the head. Why does it matter? Every £1 billion we saved, well, ultimately for the taxpayer, equated directly to 50,000 junior nurses' salaries or 300,000 primary school places. So, you know, we said, I used to stand up at town hall meetings and say, you know, generally I wouldn't proclaim this to be God's work, but it's probably the second best thing because, you know, you love public service. And every £1 billion you're saving means that the country can afford more nurses, can afford better education. And they're the choices that the government they can make because of the fantastic work you all are doing. And again, that sort of rationalizes £1 billion, 50,000 junior nurses' salary. And then the heart, you get connected by why do we all join here? Because we love public service, we have that public service ethos. And we want to do the right thing. We feel, you know, fantastic about supported citizens. And then, you know, you found people got great momentum, great culture, and really unleashed some of the most talented individuals across Britain to do some fantastic work.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Mr. Brightside, the Killers. It's another one where you put the glass down and go dancing.
Gosh, this is, I guess, partly the band and also the song. So Killers loved Brandon Flowers and the band, and they kind of hit, in the mid-2000s probably. And Newman and Mr. Brightside. And I remember our kids at the time probably were teenagers, and we got them in the car one day and just took them off to Birmingham, the NEC, to see the Killers. And this band was just electric. They kind of didn't have, you know, if you go to Taylor Swift, you know, it's just like a show. It's just like unbelievable. But if you went to the Killers, it's like a very simple stage, but the music was pulsating. And so I have, again, happy memories of the kids love the Killers. We love the Killers. Good, great band. And actually, gosh, I'd pinch myself. One of our big company sort of conferences for customers, where we must have had, I don't know, about 15,000 people in Chicago at Sage Summit when our CEO of Sage. And we had a lot of entertainment. And one of them was a band night, and we got the Killers to play, which was like, wow. So I was, you know, pinch myself. Standing in the gods at the side of the stage, had met the band before. And so I thought, well, got to have Mr. Brightside. Coming out of my cage, and I've been doing just fine. Gotta be down because I want it all. It started out with a kiss, how did it end up like this? It was only a kiss, it was only a kiss. Now I'm falling asleep, and she's calling a cab. While he's having a smoke, and she's taking a drag. Now they're going to bed, and my stomach is sick. And it's all in my head, but she's touching his chest.
I'm going to rush through the last couple of questions. I know you're tight for time, but it doesn't surprise me now. The next thing I want to ask you is about what you call compassionate capitalism and the different things you've done through Sage Foundation. But I know it's a lot more too. I'm sure you carry on doing things. What you just told me in the last 30, 40 minutes or so from growing up and your family values to working with the government. I mean, it's very clear that you mentioned the heart a few times. It's very clear it's coming from the right place, the things you're doing. So tell me about the compassionate capitalism, you know, things you've done in the past, you're currently doing with Sage Foundation, domestic violence, and so on. Just what are you doing at the moment in that space?
And the threat, actually, I got huge admiration for many generations before. In the UK, there was sort of... And it was born out of religion, I think, at the time, but I don't associate with that. But the Roundtrees, the Cadburys, the Quakers built basically a totally different philosophy in Victorian England, where they built towns for their employees. And they really cared for them. They built hospitals and they provided education. And I think that was pioneering at the time. And I just think business, we've sort of lost our way, because it's not all about profit. And, you know, what compassionate capitalism has at its heart is putting purpose on a par with profit. So I talk about, it's really two things, putting purpose front and center of companies to do the right thing, to make a difference, but also to serve all stakeholders with much greater equality. And back to what I said, if you have great customers and they're loyal and you do a fantastic job for them and you have amazingly engaged colleagues, then, you know, 99% of the time you're going to have an amazing business and all the stakeholders are going to be happy and your investors most of all, I guess, will be. And the fruits of the labor will be enjoyed by your investors. So when I went to Sage, and I've been inspired by a number of people as leaders, one of whom is Marc Benioff, who founded Salesforce.com. And, you know, it's a company that's unbelievable, like $150 billion of value. He only founded 20 years ago. But he set up a Salesforce Foundation that I effectively used as a model when I went to Sage. And we introduced this Sage Foundation. To be honest with you, there was quite a bit of cynicism about it initially. But they had the concept that it was a simple sort of concept where you'd give 2% of the employee time, all of us as employees, so 5 days a year paid volunteering. You'd have 2% of notionally free cash flows generated by the company going to support the charitable foundation. And you give two free products to any not-for-profit or charity to run their back office operation more efficiently so their funds could actually go to the causes that they're passionate about. So this was something amazing. And in the sort of 3.5-4 years I was there, it became the beating heart of the company. And just to the point where, and I didn't realize this would be the case, it's almost like an unexpected consequence. I used to do a lot of fireside chats with high performers, women, technology folks across the company. And also I did recent joiners, like people who have joined in the last year. And that cohort, I used to ask them, you know, what was the motivation for you joining Sage? And it got to a stage where about 40% of them said, probably the most important thing is, it's obviously a company with a soul, a heart, and that's expressed through the Sage Foundation. And I want to work for companies that really care about, you know, not only the environment, but the community, and have a really strong philanthropic element to their business model. So it was very important. And I sit here, but I should give the team the whole credit. There were some amazing people. We hired Debbie Wall to lead the Sage Foundation, but she had and built a fantastic team. But it mobilized 15,000 people in the company to really, you know, roll up their sleeves and do some fantastic works in the community, whether it was with food banks, whether it's helping homeless people, whether it's helping military veterans get back into work and interview practice and stuff like that, whether it's helping in refuges with domestic violence. So we couldn't sort of be all things to all people. So we picked primarily youth and women and ex-service people to sort of focus our efforts on. And I remember, you know, one of the projects that was, quite bold was there's about over 200 young people who are either sofa surfing or sleeping rough in Newcastle, which was sort of our hometown. We had 2,000 people employed there. And we decided one day, wouldn't it be great if we tried to work with the agencies and the local council and other businesses to be a lightning rod to carry the flame to try and eradicate youth homelessness and give people a chance. So, you know, 18 to 25 year olds. And actually we started a few pilots with some fantastic charities there and funded them to do great work and actually made a dent into the homelessness young people in Newcastle. So those sort of models where you really make a difference, you deliver some fantastic achievements to allow people to change their lives and take the right road and open up opportunities is something I think should be embedded into the DNA of every company. And I just think, you know, it's so easy, Andrew, you're probably, you know, if you live in Dublin or you live in a great city like Dublin or London, you can leave your office and within 50 yards, you can see 3 or 4 homeless people. And I always think there, for the grace of God, absolutely go I. If I'd taken a few turns, got into the wrong group, wrong peer group, you know, done some silly things, I could have ended up in that situation. So what is inconceivable to me is you kind of sit in a world where it's like fantastic business and, you know, all the things you associate with business in a glass office. And then you walk out onto the pavement and there's people who don't even have a meal or don't even have a roof over their head. And I think, you know, it's just there's such wasted human capital living on our streets. It's just madness. I think it's our responsibility to try and give them a chance and an opportunity and do things like put a roof over their head, have them fed and make sure they look after their own well-being ultimately, but also trying to get them a job. If they've got a roof over their head, they're eating, they're reducing their substance dependency or they're eliminating that and they get into a job, then there's a really good chance that they can have a life without deprivation ahead of them. So that's the essence of compassionate capitalism. And obviously, why does it make sense? It's because these businesses are the wealth generators of the economy and they pay their taxes to fund public services. But I think they can do way more than that in terms of taking responsibility for the wider community and supporting the communities around them and the disadvantaged to drive, you know, the ethos of what they want to achieve, not only for their company, but to make a difference in their communities around them.
Fantastic. It's a much better answer than I was hoping for. So thanks for that. That's great. Tell me about Ziggy Stardust, Debbie Bowie, and then I'll ask you the last question, let you go.
Andrew, it's great to chat to you, actually. And so Ziggy Stardust, my brother and I, you know, love him and miss him desperately. And we were just like, as kids, we're kind of running around, as I said, like swallows and hams. But also he was the guy who sort of introduced me, a role model for music. And in those times, it was all the stuff from Muddy Waters, the Ramones, New York Dolls, and then later on the Clash, Sex Pistols, all that sort of stuff. Back in the 70s, but probably the one person who stood out above all was David Bowie, and I love David Bowie, and it could be Changes, Heroes, all his just stuff was just golden. But I thought this one, Ziggy Stardust, you know, that early sort of 1970s, and it's timeless and it will live forever. And you know, David Bowie, just a legend, boy from Brixton, did good. Just you know, in terms of innovation and music and technology, he pushed the boundaries and pioneered. And also the other thing is he reinvented himself four or five times in his lifetime and his music, which really kind of appealed to a new generation at the time. Just a genius.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand.
Okay, just to wind it up, Stephen, you obviously, having been a CEO of companies, having, you know, 30 plus years of in business and having seen through innovation, you know, when you were a sage, the whole cloud computing was coming up and you guys were catching up. You know, you have to be a visionary to do what you do. But my interest is in, what do you see, what's your view on, and I don't expect a crystal ball, but what's your view in the future? What would you like to see for your daughters? You know, your just 20 years old daughters. What would you like the world to look like in a couple of years' time or 5 years' time? And what should we do?
Well, I think... you know, I think it was Winston Churchill who said, never waste a crisis. And I think the human tragedy all around us, you know, in the UK, I think probably almost every family has known someone who's either died or been personally affected by corona. So the suffering and sadness is palpable. But within that, what I love the governments to do around the world is think about, you know, what have we learned? So, down to earth level, what have we learned as human beings? And I think, you know, what I've seen is the best and sometimes the worst in people, but generally the best in people. So the sense of people stepping in into the community, again, helping the community, you know, doing food deliveries to the elderly, the vulnerable, bringing out the best of human nature in a terrible sea of human tragedy. So I think at a very basic level, what I'd love to see is that sense of community actually thriving and being vibrant across all our communities, across Ireland, across the UK. It's just like, you know, that stereotypical rose-tinted glasses of what was the like 1950s in Ireland, like everybody left their door open, everybody knew each other's name, everybody watched out for each other, you know, whether or not it was the case, we had an illusion, there was no crime. And it was like a very, it brought out the best in people. And I think, you know, we've seen that behavior and applauded it, both in our leaders, in our healthcare workers, in just normal people every day, and our business leaders. I think we've seen some exceptional examples, you know, the guy, Kurt Geiger, Neil Clifford, who's took immediately a 50% pay cut. And he said, you know, all healthcare workers can have a 50% discount in our stores or online. Those sort of things where people did the right thing, didn't even think about it, did the right thing, and trusted their instincts. I think that's very, very, very compelling. I hope we hang on to that. I guess the other thing that I hope we take advantage of and talk about really is obviously that once we get through Corona, the biggest national and international and global emergency is climate change. And we've seen evidence where, you know, look up at the sky and we don't see all the Aer Lingus and Ryanair planes. And, you know, I know we all love to travel and go on holidays, but we've changed our behavior immeasurably in 8 weeks. So do we need to go on all that business travel? We're using Zoom. Do we need to fly to California all the time? So would we be prepared to change our ways? Do we need to all those car journeys? Would we actually change, you know, our diet and stuff like that to use less of the planet's scarce resources? So I do think, actually, it makes me hugely optimistic when I've seen how much sacrifice humans are prepared to make over Corona, whether we could take that forward. And again, governments, could they galvanize public opinion to say, actually, we want to get carbon neutral, not by 2050, maybe by 2040, because we've now got so much evidence to say there's so much goodwill across the nations of the world to actually change their behaviors to make the planet sustainable. So obviously, you know, I do worry about things like climate change. I want to make sure, I think we all do, want the next generation to inherit an Earth that has much beauty and you know, a world with fewer storms, fewer rise in waters, fewer, you know, extreme weather conditions, and ultimately rise in temperatures. So I do think there's a lot of optimism around that could be translated and be a real momentum game changer to actually have a broader conversation about what world we want to live in, how we want society to be, how we want it to be really full of humanity, more compassion, more love, more sense of community, and, you know, to really now galvanize both public opinion and government policy to say we really are going to tackle this climate change and we're going to go about it really aggressively and we think we can make a difference. And I think that would be, you know, it would be amazing to think that a terrible pandemic could actually have some unintended consequences that create goodness in terms of how we live together, but also that we enjoy the planet for eternity.
Well, Stephen, I could talk to you all day, but I know you have other things to do. So I'm going to always ask everybody before the last song, a couple of words of wisdom, as I like to call them, but basically a quote, anything that gets you up in the morning.
So, you know, the advice I give, I do things, go to schools and talk at their speech shows and stuff. And, you know, it sounds a bit trite, maybe a bit clear, but I think it's so true. Follow your dreams, and in a job, do what you love, because the next generation of 18-year-olds might be working till they're 70, 75, they'll live till 100. And therefore, if you don't do what you love, the golden rule about life is be true to yourself and ultimately be kind to yourself. And now, if you don't know what you love, and I think 18 or even 20, I didn't know what I loved till I was, you know, late 20s. So how do you find out? Go and try loads of stuff. Test drive different things. You know, road test different jobs, internships, do different things and find out, do I like working in an office? Do I work outdoors? Do I like working with people? Do I like, you know, management roles? Whatever it is. But you'll find what floats your boat. And, you know, I think ultimately the best advice I could ever give is just be true to yourself and be kind to yourself. But if you do what you love and you follow your dreams, you're likely to be well on the way.
Fantastic. And the last song is Stars by Les Misérables.
Wow. So we love musicals. I've seen all the musicals. I confess, I've probably seen Les Misérables must be 15 times. Seen the movie, I don't know, loads of times too. And it's got everything. It's got love. It's got passion. It's got the Civil War. It's got betrayal. It's just got every probably emotion of life wrapped up in a couple of hours and supported by beautiful music, some great characters. And this song, actually, one of my daughter's favorite songs, talks about the story, I guess, of eternity, but also, you know, the good and the bad and the fugitive running, who's a good guy. And, yeah, again, it just shows you, there, but for the grace of God, go anywhere. For stealing a loaf of bread, he goes away for 20 years or something in a really kind of tough hard labor prison environment, and then Drake's parole. Just shows you that it's got everything about life in it, Les Miserables, and Stars is one of the iconic songs. They're all iconic songs, actually. Drink With Me, To All the Friends I've Lost, and I'm Still Here. So it's got a great sense of guilt, betrayal, love, hunting down the fugitive, and the right and wrong, and the strength of that sort of black and white, which is never the case. It's always a lot grayer. So Stars is a great way to finish. And Andrew, I've really enjoyed chatting to you.
Really appreciate it, Stephen. As well.
Love what you're doing. I think you're doing a fan, you know, what you do through these podcasts. Just gives you a lens on the world that you don't often get. It's just very thoughtful, and I think it's brilliant.
Really appreciate it, Stephen. Stephen Kelly, thanks a million for your time, and I'll sure see you again soon, hopefully.
Great stuff, Andrew. Thanks a
million. Thank you.
There, out in the darkness, a fugitive running, fallen from grace, fallen from grace. God be my witness, I never shall yield, till we come face to face, till we come face to face. He knows his way in the dark, but mine is the way of the Lord. Those who follow the path of the righteous shall have their reward. And if they fall as Lucifer fell, the flame, the sword. Stars in your multitude, scarce to be counted, filling the darkness with order and light. You are the sentinels, silent and sure, keeping watch in the night, keeping watch in the night. You know your place in the skies, you hold your course and your aim. Each in your season returns and returns, and is always the same. And if you fall as Lucifer fell, you fall in flame. And so it has been, and so it's written on the doorways to paradise, that those who falter and those who fall must pay the price. Scarce to be counted, changing the chaos to order and light. You are the sentinels, silent and sure, keeping watch in the night, keeping watch in the night.